Welcome, welcome, welcome to the first ever episode of the What If podcast powered by IntentFit. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a long time coming and I cannot tell you how excited and thrilled I am to be here. Over a year ago, my brother and I started our own company, and having a podcast was a part of the roadmap. For me, it was top of the list. And so I'm super excited that it has finally come to fruition, and I'm stoked to be here. I think before we jump into today, I kind of want to just kind of introduce what the goal of the podcast is, what I'm looking to get out of it. Obviously, any and everything is fluid, so nothing is set in stone. This is episode one. Who knows how it's going to go? Hopefully really well. In either case, this is going to be kind of a mix between solo casting as well as having guests on. For the solo podcast, kind of what my aim is to have people come, or for myself to cover various topics that are all going to be related to growth mindset, personal growth, personal development, health, wellness, fitness, everything that personally I'm very, very passionate about. I love to just do everything I can to be the best version of myself. And these solo casts will hopefully be something that I can then project on to the audience so that you guys can get the most out of it as well. When we have guests on, it'll be much more free flowing. And I don't know if there's going to be much of an agenda. We might come with a topic. But at the end of the day, the goal that I have for myself, at least with this podcast, it's just to have fun, have as much fun as possible, and add as much value as I possibly can as well. So I'm very excited about this. I'm always up for feedback. So if at the end of any episode you guys want to leave feedback, please do so. So without further ado, let's jump into this bad boy. I think this was an appropriate topic in my mind to start with, which is vulnerability. I am in a room with three cameras facing me and a mic by myself. This is about as vulnerable as it gets in terms of putting yourself out there. So I felt like this was an appropriate topic to start with. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to split this up into two series. Today, we're going to cover topics around vulnerability as it pertains to friendships, romantic relationships, why we fear them, and why it matters, and what tools we can use or implement to better those relationships. We're also going to talk about vulnerability as it relates to masculinity in today's society. I think that's an important topic to cover. And then we're going to finish up with spirituality, religion, and philosophy, and how that ties into vulnerability. So I'm really excited. Next week, we'll talk about vulnerability as it pertains to performance, growth, and leadership, but that is for another day. Hopefully by the end of today's conversation, you guys will understand what vulnerability is, why it's essential across relationships and culture, and how we can apply it for personal growth and deeper connection. So let's jump right into this bad boy. Vulnerability in friendship. Vulnerability sounds like the truth and feels like courage. Truth and courage aren't always comfortable, but they are never a sign of weakness. Brené Brown. Brené Brown is a researcher and author who specializes in vulnerability. She has a tremendous amount of, I believe, written work, but I've also seen many of her TED Talks. She's fantastic. So if you're interested in exploring this topic even further than what we go in today, I encourage you to go check her out. So let's start with vulnerability in friendship. So why is it so scary to be vulnerable in front of your friends? Well, obviously, there's a fear of rejection that's associated with it. When you put yourself out there, you don't know how someone's going to respond. You don't know what the judgment, the outward judgment's going to be. You don't know if that individual is going to go behind your back and tell other people. So being vulnerable can be very scary, particularly in friendships, because that's, let's face it, that's you're putting yourself out there and you're risking your social status, which is, as we all know, an important part of our needs as an individual, as a human, as a person who wants to be respected and loved and appreciated. To be vulnerable, you're putting all of that at risk. Not only that, but there are you know, physiological stressors that we go through when we, before we even get into the conversation of vulnerability. We activate our sympathetic nervous system, which raises our cortisol levels, increases our blood pressure, increases our heart rate, our palms get sweaty, we have difficulty thinking about what we're going to say, how we're going to say it. All of the things that maybe you had planned previously go out the window. So it's not just a social construct, it's also a physiological response that we have to overcome when we're going through these conversations. I also think it's important to call out the fact that we live in a time in an era where social media is very predominant, and we tend to look at everyone else's life through curated lenses where, you know, they're showing you their vacations and their nice cars and everything about their life that's nice and shiny. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, that's just a facade, or it's at the very least a curated version of what they want you to see. It's not the full picture. It's not the full spectrum. But it is something that plays very heavy in the psyche of every individual who wants to open up and who wants to be vulnerable. And it is important to be vulnerable, particularly in friendships. I kind of want to go into a study that I came across, I think, that would be pretty powerful. So in 2015, a large-scale analysis published in the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships examined over 800 adult friendships, and it found that self-disclosure, specifically sharing fears, regrets, and insecurities, was the single strongest predictor of closeness and satisfaction in friendships, even above shared interests or time spent together. This study showed that friends who engage in open, vulnerable conversations were four times more likely to describe their relationship as deeply supportive compared to friends who avoided discussing personal struggles altogether. I think that's really, really powerful because it highlights that it's the time that's accrued in a friendship is obviously important, and you build bonds and you know, your relationship's naturally going to grow over time. But if you're never open with that other individual, you know, the question I would ask is that really a friendship? Is that something that you can consider genuine, or is it just surface level? Is it just something that, you know, looks good, feels good, but doesn't really have much depth, much breadth to it? So I really like that study, because I think being vulnerable with your friends, although it be scary, is a fantastic way to build a true long-lasting connection. Now, as it pertains to romantic relationships, look, guys, I'll be the first one to admit I am by no means a romantic intimacy counselor by any means. I'm just going to go through what I've learned, and then we'll explore it together. But having said that, I think it's important to call out that there are differences in being vulnerable from the woman's perspective and the man's perspective. Women are, you know, expected to be sensitive and emotional. They're much more open, whereas men are much more closed off, much more reserved. And there's a reason for it. Look, the elephant in the room, as far as I'm concerned, is when a man is vulnerable, depending on what the vulnerability is, of course, that is not, it has the potential to be very unattractive to women. And I know that that's a difficult pill to swallow, but men traditionally in ancient society, as well as today's society, are expected to be emotionally stable, and being vulnerable, you're putting yourself out there to display instability in your emotions. And the last thing that any man wants to be is unattractive, regardless of where you are in the relationship. It could be brand new, or it could be 10 years deep. At the end of the day, you want your partner, your future lover, whatever, to respect you and to be attracted to you. So I think that that's something that is very rarely discussed, but I think it's something that needs to be addressed. And then for both partners, obviously, when you're being vulnerable with one another, there's always going to be a fear of rejection. You know, you don't know what that other person's going to say or how they're going to react to your, to whatever insecurity that you're putting out there. It could be something that, again, they find unattractive or that they are just put off from, and you don't want that to be the case. Also, I think a lot of times what I see in toxic relationships is when you're open and you're honest and you're vulnerable with somebody, at the low points of that relationship, and let's be honest, those low points are going to happen inevitably, that individual then has ammunition against you, and they can bring up your insecurities, and they can, you know, tease you about maybe unrealistic ambitions or things that you've been open with them in the past. So when you're telling somebody about, if you're trying to be open and vulnerable, there's always going to be that little voice in the back of your head that's reminding you that when you tell them this, that the cat's out of the bag, and there's no going back from it, and that they have the ability to use it against you. So I think that those things are important to remember, but hopefully it's not super discouraging. And we'll talk about some things to kind of, you know, balance that out, but keep it in mind. And then this one I can certainly relate to. When we're being vulnerable in romantic relationships, just the fact of putting yourself out there, I think love, the act of love in of itself is vulnerability, right? When you love somebody and they end up breaking your heart, it's very difficult to want to then love somebody again, because you don't want to get your heart broken. You don't want to go through those experiences, those emotions again. So just the fact that you're putting yourself out there and you're giving somebody your heart, that in of itself can be a scary process. So, but why is it important? Well, just like with friendships, it builds better connections and in turn, longer lasting relationships. When we're being vulnerable and we're having conversations, we actually increase what's called oxytocin. And if you're not familiar with what oxytocin is, it's a chemical that gets released into the brain anytime that you spend anytime you spend time with somebody, if you're participating in activity with someone, if you're going on a walk, if you're playing basketball, if you're watching TV, you're building a bond. And that's exactly what they refer to it as. They call it the bonding chemical. It's called oxytocin. And I pulled up this study that was conducted back in 2005. The study from Biological Psychiatry suggests that couples who engage in at least 10 to 15 minutes of intimate conversation experience oxytocin spikes of up to 30%, strengthening feelings of closeness and connection. And to help kind of give this a little bit more context, it's a 30% rise in, I'm sorry, a 30% rise is considered a substantial shift in baseline oxytocin levels, enough to curate meaningful change about how you feel and interact with an individual. So if we want to look at it from the neurological perspective, having these conversations, albeit uncomfortable, very important to building longer lasting relationships and bonds. So I like that. And yeah, it's a good way to kind of put things into perspective for you. So I know that I kind of went into vulnerability as it pertains to these two things. The question is now is, how can we as individuals become better at having conversations and being active listeners in these relationships? And we could go down the rabbit hole with a million different things. There are tons of theories and books and this and that and that and this. But at the end of the day, I wanted to pull out three things I thought were you could apply immediately, although, albeit it takes practice, you can apply immediately. You can at least think about it, you know, when you start to explore these conversations and this vulnerability with your friends and your romantic partners. So the first one is something called empathic accuracy. So empathic accuracy, the definition that I pulled was the ability to accurately understand and infer another person's thoughts and feelings at different internal states. So I think this is somewhat self-explanatory, but essentially it's just being able to accurately understand the emotions that somebody is displaying in that moment, given context. So if somebody's upset that, I don't know, you didn't call them at a certain time, being able to relate to why that would be important to them, and then being able to understand the emotions they might be feeling. And then with that in mind, then having a conversation as to why you didn't have that, why you weren't able to commit to that, you know, where you can make changes as an individual. But again, it's just about being empathetic and accurately understanding exactly what they went through. So the next one is empathic similarity, which is pretty similar to empathic accuracy. So instead of trying to determine accurately what this other individual is going through, the similarity is you've been through it before, and so you can relate to it, and so that you can then tell a story as to when you also had been vulnerable in a particular moment, how that made you feel, so that you can relate to that person. That helps break down the barriers with individuals, makes them feel more comfortable, more like they're being heard. And so I think that's both of these things, I think, are important to think about, but definitely take practice. I did write something down here that I think is important to call out as well. In both empathic accuracy as well as empathic similarity, it's not about just giving advice. I'm a very pragmatic person, so I tend to want to just give advice right off the bat, and that's not always the best thing to do. I think just listening actively and understanding that this individual is going through something and just relating to it is the best way to tackle it. Now, let's dive into the last aspect of it, which is balancing privacy with transparency. This is a really big one. Look, even though you want to open up to somebody, I think that there's a delicate balance, a delicate dance that you have to be cognizant of. And what I mean by that is you don't necessarily need to share every little detail about what your insecurity is, right? Also, maybe testing the waters a little bit, maybe not sharing the entire depth or breadth of something that you want to be open with, maybe, you know, hinting at something and kind of understanding how they react to it will give you a good understanding or a good barometer of how this interaction should go and, you know, how this individual is going to ultimately respond. And then the other thing that I want to call out here is when you're having conversations with people, being vulnerable, although in the moment can seem like a one-way street, you really need to think of it as being something that both parties should participate in. So if you're the only one that's opening up and you know, being vulnerable, if that other individual doesn't reciprocate and doesn't open up as well, I think that that's a pretty telling sign that you should be aware of. And maybe at that point you pull back a bit and you know, maybe limit the information that you're giving out there. So that's what I have for vulnerability as it pertains to relationships. I want to end with this: in both friendships and romantic relationships, vulnerability transforms connections from transactional to transformational. By practicing empathic accuracy, finding empathic similarity, and of course, balancing transparency and privacy. So let's move on. The strongest men are those most capable of acknowledging their own weakness. Jocko Willink. I absolutely love this quote, but I love that this quote is coming from Jocko. If you don't know who he is, he's a former Navy SEAL, combat veteran in the Iraq and Afghanistan war. This guy is an absolute badass, somebody that I respect fully. I don't know if he has his own podcast. I've seen him on many podcasts. If you don't know who he is, check him out. He's written many of books, books that I, to this day, will reread for personal growth reasons. But Jocko is a badass, and I love that he's willing to admit that weakness is just the first step in becoming a stronger person. So vulnerability and masculinity. Look, I think that it's important for us to dive into the historical context of this, because I think that this really sets the tone. Historically, we as men were encouraged to suppress our emotions, and the dominant behaviors were a huge part of the two most important things to any man. And I know that this is maybe going to rub some people the wrong way, but it's just the truth: power and sex. If you are vulnerable, if you are open with your emotions, you are less likely to have the opportunity to reproduce, and it also affects your social status, particularly in masculine groups. So I think that that's really, again, an uncomfortable realization, but it's one that we all have to be cognizant of, and I have a study here that I want to go into. So let's do it. And this use case was back in the early 90s, a gentleman by the name of Christopher Boehm, who was an American cultural anthropologist, did some field work on hunter-gatherers in Tanzania, which is in East Africa. And these hunter-gatherers are a part of the Hadza group. And what the study showed was that men formed dominance-based coalitions for hunting large game and protecting the group. In these coalitions, emotional restraint during high-risk hunts was observed as essential. Men who displayed overt fear or hesitation were less likely to be chosen for future hunts, which impacted their social status and reproductive opportunities. Boehm documented that stoicism and emotional control were reinforced culturally, with older men ridiculing or socially punishing younger men who showed fear by teaching them to suppress vulnerability and maintain group cohesion. So this just kind of highlights kind of what we as a species or as a culture kind of have evolved with this type of norm, these expectations. But as powerful as that is, we no longer live in this type of society. And although that those are still inherently built within us, there are, at this point, I'd say, huge factors in the degradation of mental health in today's society. Higher levels of emotional suppression correlate to a number of things, which include increased rates of mood disorders. Think of bipolar disorder. Substance abuses, such as drugs and alcohol, as we all know, and increased suicides. Here's a stat for you. Men represent 75% of all global suicide deaths, attributed at least in part to reluctance to express distress. There's also some physiological effects associated with it. Hypertension, increased risk of heart disease, impaired immune function. So again, it's not just socially driven, it's also physiologically driven, that when we suppress our emotions, they can have some serious detrimental, outcomes. I want to read you another study here, that kind of highlights this fact even further. The Journal of Counseling Psychology in 2017 meta-analysis on conformity to masculine norms and mental health outcomes. Men who strongly endorse traditional masculine norms of stoicism and emotional control were two and a half times more likely to experience severe depression, three times more likely to report chronic loneliness, and two times more likely to meet criteria for generalized anxiety disorder compared to men who expressed emotions more openly. Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot that plays into suicide and depression and anxiety. There's no doubt, right? It's not just a suppression of your emotions, but nevertheless, I think that this is something that really emphasizes the fact that when we're not open, we're not really being self-reflective. And when we're not being self-reflective, we're not growing as individuals. and this can have some detrimental effects on us. It's having gone through the education of this has been a huge eye opener for me. But I don't want to leave you on that. I want to kind of dive into how we can tackle this. And this, I would say, pertains to both men and women, although I know everything I read before this is kind of been a little bit more male dominated, but for the women, the three women that will probably listen to this, what solutions exist? So first and foremost, I would call out journaling. I think this is a really good introduction to being vulnerable to ourselves. And again, going back to self-reflection, right? Like journaling, you don't need to sit down with anybody. You don't need to talk to anybody. You're probably less likely to go through the physiological stress that we mentioned earlier. And it's a simple way just to sit down and have a conversation with yourself, discuss the emotions that you're feeling, why you're feeling that way, you know, identify certain triggers, how to avoid them, everything that kind of comes along with being, you know, open about your emotions. I think journaling is beautiful. You know, it takes 15 minutes, 20 minutes a day tops. You don't have to make it, you know, a ritual aspect of your day, but do it when you feel at your lowest points, but great entry point to being more open. The other one is peer support groups. I remember living in San Diego. I lived in San Diego for 6 years, and I remember being down there. And I remember being invited to various men's groups where we would work out on the beach, and then we'd then sit around a circle and talk about our life, our ambitions, our goals, and, you know, maybe sing Kumbaya. I don't have any idea what that was all about, but I'd never joined. Nevertheless, there's nothing wrong with it. I do think that it's a great way to meet people who may be struggling with the same things as you. And the best way to find these men's groups, I believe, is Facebook, Meetup, or maybe you have, maybe you can start your own. Maybe you can get a group of your friends and you guys can start your own men's group. So I love that. Now, the last one here is cognitive reappraisal training. So this is something that I think that I've done instinctually. I don't think that I was ever taught to do this. I certainly don't remember being taught to do this, but nevertheless, it's something that I inherently do most of the time. When I'm facing a challenge, an issue, and I'm just going to read what I have and then we'll talk through it. So essentially, cognitive reappraisal training is known as a technique that manages emotions by reinterpreting the meaning of a situation rather than suppressing or avoiding it. It involves changing how you think about a potential stressful or negative event to lessen the emotional impact. So I think that there's two ways to tackle this, and I want to do a whole episode on these terms, but the first one is pre-framing, and the second one is reframing, and maybe you've heard of one of these, I'm not sure, maybe both, who knows, but essentially pre-framing is before you go into a situation that you might deem stressful or you might be vulnerable, thinking about it from a positive aspect. How are you ultimately going to become a better person because of it? Let's use the example of public speaking, because I think that everyone can relate to this, right? 77 or 80% of all people fear public speaking. But going into a public speaking engagement can be terrifying. And the way that I like to look at it is, okay, I'm going to go up there, I'm going to give my best, and if it turns out to be horrible and I fall on my face, at the very least, I'll have a very, very funny story to tell my brother or my sister or my parents or whoever later down the line, right? Because it's not the end of the world. You're not going to die from it. You know, it happens to the best of us. Public speaking is scary. We tend to freeze up. But if you can go into it thinking like, okay, I'm going to do my best, but if I don't, it's going to be a hell of a story to tell later. I think that's a great example of pre-framing. And then reframing is after something has happened, going back and reflecting on it and thinking, okay, well, this didn't turn out the way that I thought it was going to turn out, or God, this was way worse than I thought it was going to be. Telling yourself like, okay, how can I be a better person because of it? How can I reevaluate? What went wrong? Was it that I prepared poorly? Was it that I didn't do X, Y, and Z during the presentation? Oh, it doesn't even matter what the scenario is. It's all about going back and reflecting on what you've done and then trying to grow from it, as opposed to stewing in it, or letting it fester in your mind as a flaw or something that didn't go the way you thought it was going to go. I think those are great techniques, and it kind of goes right into the cognitive reappraisal training theory. So I love that. That's it for that session. Let's jump into the next section, which I find super entertaining: spiritual lens. All right, spiritual lens. This is a fun one. What I'm going to do here is we're going to cover all five of the major religions: Christianity, Judaism, or I like to say Judaism. I don't know why, but it's a fun way to say it. Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. We're going to go through each one. I'm going to read what I have on the paper here first, and then I'm going to talk out loud as to why I chose it and why I think it fits beautifully into the topic of vulnerability. So let's start with Christianity. Before I begin, I just want to call out, I am not a religious person. I think that I've always been and always will be on my spiritual journey, but I do not adhere to any of these religions, so I am not biased to any of these religions. I've read the Bhagavad Gita, which is the Hindu text, many years ago, probably about 7-8 years ago. It was a beautiful book, very, very easy read, and an interesting read as well. I am currently reading the Bible. I'm in the very early chapters. I'm not even all the way through Exodus, which is the second chapter. It's been fantastic to read so far. I believe that if you are somebody who wants to explore spirituality, just the attempt to dive into theology, which is the study of religion, is very, very important. So I just wanted to put that out there. I don't have any biases towards any of these. I think they're all beautiful, and there's wisdom in every religion. So just wanted to caveat that. So let's start with Christianity. This is the one that I'm most familiar with, and as I mentioned, I'm kind of in the process of learning. It's been fun. It's been interesting. It's been a journey. So let's get into it. Christianity consists of teaching that acknowledging sin, weakness, and failure before God and others is a path to forgiveness and transformation. Okay, so I pulled a story that I thought was really good, and I'm going to read through it, and then we're going to talk about this. So it's the context of Paul's thorn. Paul's thorn, okay? You can find the story in Corinthians 12:7-10. And the story goes as such. Paul describes being given, quote, a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment me, to keep me from becoming conceited. He writes that he pleaded with God three times for it to be taken away. God responds, I quote, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." Paul then declares, "Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness, so that Christ's power may rest on me." Now, I know that might be a little bit tricky to understand right away, so let's kind of break this down a little bit. So at the very beginning, I said Paul describes being given a thorn in the flesh. What does this mean, a thorn in the flesh? Well, this is really important to understand the story. I tried to look up what they meant by a thorn in the flesh, because you just think, in literal terms, like a thorn in the flesh, but how does that relate to being conceited? I don't know. But what it spat out to me was that it could have been a potential chronic illness. It could have been a physical defect, maybe blindness, maybe, I don't know, he had a bum leg or something, maybe a speech impediment, but something that ate at his insecurity is how I interpreted it. Because obviously he's praying to God to, have this taken away from him. God then responds, no. I did this deliberately, and you're going to ultimately become a better person because of it. And then Paul leans into it. this is why I love this so much. I relate to this probably better than anything else that we're going to cover today. I was born with a bone disorder when I was obviously born, and it's affected me tremendously, but it's never been something that made me an unhappy person. I've always tried to, going back to what we discussed earlier, reframed it in a way that allowed me to be a more empathetic person, somebody that was grateful for the blessings that I did have. And I don't know who I would be had I not gone through the traumatic events of having gone through all the surgeries and operations I did. So this one really spoke to me, and I love it. I think that we can all learn from it. Nobody is perfect. If you are perfect, I'd love to meet you, but we all have insecurities. And instead of looking at those insecurities as being something that, you know, you should feel guilty about or you should feel insecure about, I think it's an opportunity for us to learn and grow as individuals and try and see the silver lining. So I love this one. This was a fantastic. I'm excited to get to it. I have a long way to get to Corinthians, but great story to use. All right, Judaism or Judaism. I don't know how you want to pronounce it. I like Judaism, but we're going to say Judaism because apparently that's more proper. Okay, so the Jewish tradition doesn't shy away from expressing fear, frustration, or confusion. Instead, it embraces emotional honesty as a pathway to deeper faith, wisdom, and understanding. The very name Israel means one who struggles with God, and it comes from Jacob's wrestling match with the angel in Genesis 32:28, which symbolizes that struggle, questioning, and vulnerability are central to the Jewish identity and relationship with the divine. Jewish tradition doesn't shy away from expressing fear, frustration, or confusion. Instead, it embraces emotional honesty as a pathway to deeper faith, wisdom, and understanding. I love this as well. And I love this because I'm not someone who just likes to take the word of others. I'm constantly questioning. I'm constantly skeptical of what I'm being told, particularly when it comes to religion. And the fact that Judaism embraces that, I think, is wonderful. And I think that in order to question things, particularly when everyone else around you is conforming to them, is one of the most challenging aspects of vulnerability and takes tremendous courage. And I just love the way that this is framed. I can also attest to it. I'm not going to get into it. Read Exodus. And when you read Exodus, you'll see that the Israelites who have been taken out of Egypt are constantly questioning God after he continuously proves his power to them. It's kind of funny. It's kind of entertaining. But love this one. This was a really, really fun one to read. Let's move on to Islam. Islam is very similar to the other two. Now, I shouldn't say it's very similar, but what I'm about to read seems very similar. So let's get into it, and then we'll talk about it. Islam teaches that embracing one's vulnerability before God, admitting faults, expressing fears, and recognizing dependence reflects spiritual maturity, not weakness. So, let me just keep going with this. Vulnerability is central to, I'm totally going to botch this word, tawaba, which is basically, I'm not going to repeat it, which is basically their version of repentance or to repent one's sins. It is the act of sincerely turning back to God after recognizing one's mistakes. It's not simply an obligation, but an opportunity for growth, healing, and renewal. The Quran repeatedly acknowledges human imperfection and invites believers to bring their fears, failures, and regrets to God. In the Quran, it states under passage 39:53, "Say, O my servants who have transgressed against themselves by sinning, do not despair of the mercy of Allah. Indeed, Allah forgives all sins." the fact that they talk about human imperfection, look, I love it. Or I've said that probably, I don't know how many times I've said it on this podcast already, but no one's perfect and no one can live a perfect life, and we're all going to make mistakes. And so I think that the idea that we can, again, go back and be open and vulnerable and admit that we've made a mistake after recognizing that it was a mistake is huge when it comes to personal growth. I have not read the Quran. Once I'm finished with the Bible, I will probably read the Quran at some point. I don't know when that's going to be, but again, I think that it's a big part of spirituality, and I thought that was a beautiful passage. All right, so the next two, the final two here, are a little bit different than the first three religions we covered. The next two are going to be Hinduism and Buddhism. As I stated earlier, I've read the Bhagavad Gita in the past. Wonderful book. It's very, very easy read. It's short. It is, it does a really good job of talking about Hinduism from a storytelling perspective. But let's get into kind of what I have here on the paper. Hinduism, the key or the main idea is surrendering ego. Recognizing where pride and or stubbornness prevents growth can unlock better relationships, clearer decisions, and deeper peace. Hinduism recognizes four main paths. And side note, I'm totally going to botch these paths. Bhakti, Janana, Karma, which I think we all are familiar with, and Raja Yoga, each offering a unique approach to spiritual development. One of Hinduism's core spiritual paths, Bhakti, emphasizes surrendering the ego, admitting dependence on the divine, letting go of pride, and expressing love and devotion with complete honesty. A story out of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, I said this perfectly earlier, Arjuna, I don't know why, if I look at it, I can't read it, Arjuna's breakdown. Okay, I apologize to all the Hindu people who are probably not even listening to this. The warrior Arjuna breaks down on the battlefield, overwhelmed with fear, doubt, and moral confusion. He openly confesses his despair to Krishna, saying, "My mind is overwhelmed with weakness. I see no solution." Rather than judging him, Krishna, a deity in the Hindu religion, responds with only guidance on Dharma, purpose, and self-realization, transforming Arjuna's vulnerability into strength. All right, I apologize if I totally botched that name and if it's offensive, but in either case, this is a beautiful story. I really like it because, again, it highlights, again, the reframing perspective of taking something that may feel like a weakness, may feel like vulnerability, reflecting on it, and then ultimately turning it into a positive, into a way to be a better person. So I love that. I think this is wonderful. All right, let's keep on going, guys. We're almost there. Buddhism. So Buddhism is a fantastic religion. Side note, I always knew that it was about suffering, but I didn't realize it was basically the entire philosophy of suffering. But it's very, very interesting nevertheless. So let's read into this. The first noble truth, there's four noble truths. Acknowledging suffering. Buddhism begins with vulnerability, recognizing dukkha. D-U-K-K-H-A. I apologize if I botch that as well. That life involves suffering, dissatisfaction, and impermanence. Accepting this truth requires humility and honesty about the human condition. I really like that. Because again, I think to reframe certain instances, remember, we're not here forever. Life doesn't go on and on and on and on and on, and likely no one's going to remember who you are in 100 years. Nothing is permanent. So keeping that in mind, I think, is an important step to self-growth and to, understanding that vulnerability is only temporary. And then I just wanted to go into the steps of identifying and tackling the first noble truth, which is identifying where you feel stuck, sad, or fearful, and then observing your emotions without labeling them good or bad. If you've ever taken a yoga class, you know this is a big part of it. Just sitting there with your thoughts, not giving any sort of attention to anyone for any specific reason, just recognizing that they exist. It helps to break cycles and avoid self-criticism. I love that. That's really, really cool. Kind of difficult to do, but with practice, I think is great. And then remembering that pain, like joy, is only temporary. And with that mindset, you can ease anxiety and foster gratitude for the present moment. Great. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Buddhism is very interesting. They do not have a written text. I don't think, but I'd like to explore that religion as well at some point. So let's bring this bad boy home. We're going to just touch on one aspect of philosophy. If you know me, you know how much I love philosophy. It has been a very, very pivotal study of mine in my life. I am not dogmatic about anything per se, but I do think that Stoic philosophy specifically has been a tool to ground me in during life's challenges, and I'm so grateful that I've been able to be diligent about my study around Stoic philosophy. I try to promote it as much as possible at a respectful level, of course, but I love it. So let's dive into how that fits into vulnerability or, yeah. So contrary to the stereotype of emotional suppression, Stoic thinkers such as Epictetus and Seneca taught that vulnerability is inherent to the human, to human existence. We don't control events. We can only control our responses. And then a quote from Seneca, who is one of the more predominant figures in Stoicism: "No man is more unhappy than he who never faces adversity, for he is not permitted to prove himself." I'm going to read that one more time. No man is more unhappy than he who never faces adversity, for he is not permitted to prove himself. That is awesome. That is awesome because it fits right into everything that we've been talking about today, which is without being vulnerable, we cannot grow as individuals. It's silly to think that we can hide behind a mask that portrays ultimate strength and omnipotence and all of these grandioso things that quite frankly are not human at all. We're vulnerable, insecure creatures, but it's when we are open to our vulnerability and that we reflect on our vulnerability that we become better and that we grow and that it makes life better, and we can really, really lean into that. So I love it. All right, I'm going to leave you guys with this last thing because we've done it. We're here. We've done it. Episode one is coming to a conclusion. Vulnerability is not weakness. Across traditions, it is a necessary portal to wisdom, humility, and spiritual maturity. Accepting our limitations opens us to growth, resilience, and deeper connections with ourselves, others, and the transcendent. Love it. Awesome. Guys, thank you so much. Hopefully there's not too much editing in here I have to do. I see my computer is giving me some sort of sign. It looks like it's still recording my audio. If I don't have an engineer in here, I'm the engineer. So if something had messed up, I'm going to have to re-record this. But in either case, I'm sure that it went well. Thank you so much. And if you guys enjoyed today's episode, I'm going to run it back again next week. We will continue the topic of vulnerability, but we are going to focus on performance, growth, and leadership, how vulnerability intersects with pursuing goals, developing resilience, and improves leadership aspirations. That is going to be an exciting episode. And I'll continue to bring you guys the absolute fire. Also, like I had mentioned before, I want this to be a guest-driven podcast as well. I'm trying to get, there's two people that I want to get in here as soon as possible. But I don't know what that looks like, so I'm not going to make any promises. Having said that, thank you so much for your time. Peace, love, and unity. And we'll meet again soon. Thanks, everybody.